Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter Isaacson is the Leonard Lauder Professor of American History and Values at Tulane University and the past CEO of the Aspen Institute, where he is now a Distinguished Fellow. He's been the chairman of CNN and the editor of Time magazine. Readers know him as the biographer of Leonardo da Vinci, Steve Jobs, Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and Henry Kissinger, among many other books. Today, we're talking about his new and exciting work, The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's so wonderful to talk to you again, Susan.
Oh, thank you. Now, one of the things I love about your books is how well you explain complex processes through the lens of interesting individuals. So talk about how you were drawn into the life of Jennifer Doudna, who shared the 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Emmanuel Charpentier, and for the development of a gene editing tool.
I think that we're about to enter a great, exciting new age of the life sciences. Just like you and I, Susan, we grew up during the digital revolution, which was this amazing time defined by computers and microchips and the internet. Now, molecules are becoming, you know, the new microchip. Mm-hmm. We see that with our vaccines for COVID. You know, we program RNA to make these vaccines. And I think that's mysterious to some people. But frankly, it's pretty easy. In fact, the technology for both those vaccines and the gene editing tool I write about, bacteria have been doing it for a billion years. So I figure if bacteria can figure it out, you know, you and I can figure it out. And so I try to make it a very simple journey of adventure and discovery with Jennifer Doudna. We go hand in hand with her and her competitors and her colleagues, so that we can all understand this new world we're entering, where we can edit our genes to fix bad diseases, maybe even to enhance our children and make them healthier, and to make vaccines that will not only fight, you know, coronavirus, but will fight cancer and bacteria and any infection.
Well, it was so interesting to me that for so many scientists, that love begins with a book, and the book is The Double Helix by James Watson.
Yes, it's a book that my dad left on my bed here growing up on Napoleon Avenue, and it made me interested in biology. It's about how he and Francis Crick helped discover the structure of DNA and how it contains all the genes that determine things about our genetic makeup. And there's a character in the book named Rosalind Franklin. Mm-hmm. Frankly, you know, Watson's a bit condescending about her, but she does the amazing image work that helps them figure out the structure of DNA. Well, the cool thing is, when I first met Jennifer Doudna, the person who's the central character of my book, I said, "How did you get interested in all this?" And she said, "My dad left on my bed when I was in sixth grade The Double Helix, and I read and I saw that character, Rosalind Franklin, and it occurred to me, women can become scientists." And I decided that's what I wanted to do. And even though her school guidance counselor, she was growing up in Hawaii, her school guidance counselor said, "No, girls don't become scientists." Ugh. She decided that she would. And of course, now she and Emmanuel Charpentier, her research partner, win the Nobel Prize. First time two women have won the Nobel Prize for chemistry alone.
Well, the funny thing to me is that here you are all these years later, and James Watson is a character in this book.
Oh, yeah, a very strange character.
Yeah.
In some ways, he represents this journey of discovery that he writes about in The Double Helix that inspires Jennifer. But he also goes over to the dark side. He believes too much in genetic determinism and even gets into real trouble by talking about race, talking about ethnicity, and talking about things that he feels are genetic and inherited, when, of course, other scientists say no. And it's an interesting character because you do have to grapple with this notion that we can, you know, that there may be genetic differences and we can edit them and all. And so he is both one of the early on characters who helps Jennifer decide that she wants to discover the structure of RNA, which is a cooler molecule than DNA. But later, when we go visit Watson, he's cranky, and, you know, he's expressing views that I find abhorrent. And I found it important to use him as the dark side counterpart to Jennifer Doudna, who wants to use all this for good.
Well, talk about her in the sense of her arc of life is really the new professional life of a scientist. So she starts out as a scientist. She makes some really important discoveries. Then she has to add on a role as a business person as scientific discovery becomes increasingly commercialized. And then she has to use that wisdom to become a policymaker and an activist.
Absolutely, although I wouldn't say she has to become a business person.
Right.
I think I would say she gets to become a business person because I believe in business. And I believe that it's called from bench to bedside, meaning taking a discovery from the lab bench and saying, can we turn it into something that's actually useful to treat patients at the bedside? And so what she does is she takes her discovery, that CRISPR, this system that bacteria have, that are clustered, repeated sequences in their DNA, that she can engineer that into a tool that will edit our own genes. And so she starts a couple of companies, one of which detects viruses using CRISPR, another of which does therapies using CRISPR. Well, you know what? That turns out to be real important when a coronavirus pandemic hits. And her companies, as well as those of her competitors, are at the forefront of finding ways that we can more easily and directly detect and cure virus infections.
Well, I love the way her response was so immediate when she gathers the scientists in the wake of the coronavirus and goes, we have to step up and chooses what to do.
That government hadn't really stepped up to the testing crisis and to the other scientific things. And she had been such a competitor with the people, you know, with some, you know, guys at MIT, Harvard, who were racing to patent the gene editing technologies that they were both developing. But the cool thing is when coronavirus strikes, she brings a whole lot of scientists together. And she brings them together without worrying about intellectual property, without worrying about patents, publishing as soon as they make discoveries so other people can build on it. And so you see this collaboration that she helps to do when coronavirus hits. And that's a theme of the book that's not just about science. It's about everything we do, which is sometimes it's a mix of collaboration and competition. And you have to know that both have value, and she does. She's also good at getting people to collaborate and come together on the moral and ethical issues surrounding gene editing.
Well, I think that you always distill little principles along the way from what you've learned from these characters. And one of her guiding principles, which was acquired from one of her teachers, was don't be afraid. Don't and never do what 1,000 other people are doing. And that kept her work new and exciting and relevant.
She said when she liked playing soccer as a kid, that she didn't like playing the positions other kids played. She wanted to have, you know, a position that wasn't too crowded, that she could be doing something a little bit different. And when she goes into biological research, all the guys in the 1990s are rushing towards the Human Genome Project, just like boys on a soccer field. And they're all trying to sequence DNA. What Jennifer does, along with her friend Jillian Banfield and then Emmanuel Charpentier, is she says, no, RNA is the more interesting molecule. RNA and DNA both have genetic codes. They're both, in our cells. But DNA just sort of sits in the nucleus, keeping and curating our genetic code, whereas the RNA goes and makes copies of specific genes and then goes to the region of the cell where you build protein, and it actually does some work. It actually makes a protein. So Jennifer figures out how RNA works, the structure of it, and RNA becomes the molecule, as you know, that's at the heart of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. It's at the heart of the CRISPR gene editing tool. And it's because she didn't run on the field where everybody else was running. She found her own place to work.
But on the other hand, the other thing I find really endearing about her is that she wasn't afraid to make mistakes. She wasn't afraid to admit that she made mistakes either.
This is the important thing about science and reading about it, because I hate it when people say, oh, I don't like science. Science, especially the beauty of how we work as human beings, is both joyful to understand and really not that complicated. And it's important to understand the basic principle of science, which we've lost as our society sometimes when it comes to politics and other things. And that basic principle is look at the evidence and then make conclusions. And then if you've made some theories or conclusions, do more experiments, find more evidence, and be willing to revise your opinions, change your mind. And indeed, she made some mistakes, but you don't discover anything unless you make some mistakes. What causes you problems is when you have a closed mind and you make a mistake and you don't move on and say, well, let me change the way I'm doing things. That's what science teaches us. That's what all of us used to know in our lives, which is, let's not make predetermined judgments. Let's look at the facts. And somehow or another, I think in our political discourse, we've lost that talent. So I just wanted to celebrate a scientist who said, I'm open to new facts. Let's do the experiments.
Well, some of the things we take away from this book are the competitive nature of scientific discovery, for one thing, and how the publication of a scientific paper can often be just a race to the finish line, and what a difference a few days can make in that world.
Yes. The competition helps. It spurs people on to go faster. And at the heart of this book is a great race, because Jennifer Doudna and her partner Emmanuel Charpentier over in Europe discovered how to take this ancient system bacteria used to fight viruses and to repurpose it as a scissor, a molecular scissor that can cut DNA wherever you target it, meaning you want to snip out this gene, you want to replace this gene, you can do it. They did that in 2012, and they won the race to do that. But then another race happened that's even more brutal, which is for the next 6 months, they're in a race with a group of people led by Fong Zhang at MIT and Harvard to say, we can make this tool work in human cells. Because in theory, what Jennifer Doudna had created would work in any cell, but if you're going to get a patent, you have to show how can it work in a human cell? How can it get into a human cell and get into the nucleus and actually work? And they race for 6 months, and in January 2013, both of them crossed the finish line. But Fong Zhang's group published 2 weeks earlier that January, and they've been locked in patent battles ever since. So sometimes competition spurs people on, and sometimes it becomes rough.
Mm-hmm. What you're painting here is really the global world. I mean, so many of the scientists you're writing about are immigrants who come to the U.S. to make their mark. But you introduce us to scientists from all over the world who are working together in a meeting in international gatherings, working via Zoom, exchanging lab people. And it really is a global world in the sense that it should be, don't you think?
Discovery is a team sport these days, and the teams are international. So when Jennifer is doing it on discovering this gene editing tool, she's working with this partner I mentioned, Emmanuel Charpentier. They eventually will win the Nobel Prize. They won the Nobel Prize, but before they win it, they're working. Emmanuel is working in Sweden, even though she had been born in Paris. They have one graduate student who's working in Vienna, and another who comes from the Czech Republic, and they're all working together on Zoom. Likewise, the other teams are all international. In fact, working on Zoom and in Dropbox, they work 24 hours a day because they'll just turn it over when it gets to be nighttime in one place. And so I think that's another lesson from the book, is how do we do collaboration in the digital age?
Thinking of a world in the light of the sun, and all the many lives that were ever begun. Our little world turning in the blue, as each day goes, there's another one new. Another one new.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker: Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. Now, one of the things that makes this book so important and so winning to the reader is that you go into great length about the ethical issues that these discoveries present. You know, how will we use them? Will we use them to enhance human capabilities or to cure diseases? I mean, sickle cell anemia is one example you used. So talk about the various lines of thinking.
Well, I think everybody would agree it's really great to use gene editing technology in patients, you know, living patients that have bad genetic diseases, such as sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis or Huntington's or Tay-Sachs disease. Where it starts getting trickier is when you say, let's edit the genes of our children. And
yeah,
let's do it, you know, when they're embryos, so that it'll affect all the cells in their body, and for that matter, all future generations. And that's where Jennifer Doudna flinches a bit and says, let's gather people from around the world for a series of discussions to say, do we really want to make inheritable gene edits? And I initially said, no, that sounds like you're really messing with Mother Nature or you're trying to play God. I've become a little bit more open to it. The first person to make inheritable genetic edits was a Chinese doctor who edited the embryos of twin girls so that they were resistant to the virus that causes AIDS. And I thought that was bad when that was announced in 2018. But now that we've gone through a viral pandemic, I think, all right, maybe we should be open to things that are medically necessary if it's going to make our species healthier. I mean, every other species does that.
Well, it's so fascinating because you know, you have this long passage where you're questioning what you would do if you were editing the genes of your children. And it's, you know, it's a very human journey that you take us on. Would I do this? I don't
know.
Right. You know?
And I want everybody who's reading the book not to say, here's the answer. I don't try to preach. I say, come with me on this journey of discovery and come with Jennifer Doudna because she's going through it too. And let's go hand in hand and think, would we edit our children if we knew they were going to have a genetic disease like Huntington's or Tay-Sachs or sickle cell? And my answer is yes. But there's a kid in the book with sickle cell who says, I'm not so sure. Maybe sickle cell gave me character and made me who I am. And then you get to the question of, it's pretty easy to edit a gene that would allow us to have more muscle mass. So would you do that to have your kids be stronger or maybe taller? Would you do it to make sure they didn't go deaf or blind from a congenital deafness or blindness? So we each have to think of what we would do and what rules we want governments to impose on us. I remember sitting on my balcony, the 800 block of Royal Street, and I'm looking at all the people parading below. You know, it's a real parade of humanity, people tall and short and fat and skinny and straight and gay and trans and, you know, every hue and every color.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, that's so wonderful, the diversity of our species. It's what makes our species flavorful. It's what makes our species strong. What if we let everybody edit all the genes of their kids? Will we lose some of our diversity? Would the rich buy better genes for their kids? These are not easy questions, but they're ones we can all wrestle with. And that's what, you know, the last quarter of the book does, is it talks about, all right, let's have some thinking of, here's some cases. What would you do?
So much to think about. We've been talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book, The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing and the Future of the Human Race, will keep you turning pages. Available Tuesday, March 9th. Walter, it's been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much.
Susan, it's always great to visit with you.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? The Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival returns for its 18th conference, Friday, March 12th through Sunday, March 14th, with literary discussions, writing workshops, readings, and special events, all via Zoom or YouTube. The writing workshop series features Dorothy Allison, Michael Nava, Matthew Clark Davison, Radcliffe, and Jewel Gomez. Literary panels and discussion topics include a wide array of genres, including mystery, romance, young adult, poetry, memoir versus fiction, and short fiction. The literary luminaries of the Violet Quill, Andrew Halloran, Felice Picano, and Edmund White, will appear, and there will be a discussion of Jewish lesbian literature and activism with Alana Dykewoman, Judith Katz, Irina Klepfisch, and Michelle Carlsberg. A new addition this year is the Conversation series, featuring authors interviewing authors. Brian Washington will discuss his first novel, Memorial, with author Matthew Griffin. Scholar and poet Julie Enzer facilitates a dialogue with literary icon Judy Caron about her new book, Eruptions of Inanna, Justice, Gender, and Erotic Power. Journalist Maren Jones discusses sex and censorship in the modern gay rights movement with author and political activist Naomi Wolf. And founder of the Son of Baldwin media community, Robert Jones Jr., discusses his groundbreaking new novel, The Prophets, with me. Jen Shapland and Carlos Dues discuss their passion for the work of Carson McCullers. Dues is the founding president of the Carson McCullers Society, and Shapland was a 2020 National Book Award finalist for her work, My Autobiography of Carson McCullers. The Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival kicks off Friday, March 19th. The Writers' Retreat, March 19th through 21st, includes online writing workshops, author events, and a writing marathon. Delivering a keynote inspirational message is Robert Jones Jr. Others participating include C. Morgan Babst, Michael Byrne, Elizabeth Mickey Brina, Ethan Brown, Pamela Koloff, Lily King, Lee Camacho Rourks, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Sonny Patterson, Sharon Rosenblum, and Katie Simpson Smith. Also included is an agent pitch bootcamp and a session by Kindle Direct Publishing with Goodreads. The following weekend, March 24th through 28th, you can see such varied writers as Megan Abbott, Augustin J. Carrero, Randy Fertel, Allison Galen, Matthew Griffin, Eliza Griswold, Lady Hubbard, Peggy Scott Laborde, Laura Lippman, Lauren Markham, John Cameron Mitchell, John Pope, Alice Quinn, Mo Rocca, Brian Sands, Kalamu Yassalam, Heather Ann Thompson, Emma Walsh, Brian Washington, and many more. There will be many special events. The festival opens Wednesday, March 24th, with an online performance of a Vu Carré Cabaret. Other events include the Tennessee Williams tribute reading focused on New Orleans as Muse, and featuring Alan Cumming, Brenda Kerr, and Rodney Hicks, Anne Magnuson, Amy Ryan, Mink Stoll, Blair Underwood, and more. Books and Beignets focuses on The Rose Tattoo by Tennessee Williams this year. There will be an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright John Patrick Shanley, and Brian Batt appears in conversation with Tennessee Williams scholar Kenneth Holditch. UNO Press will present poetry readings filmed on location from the book I Am New Orleans, and a new memoir by Kalamu Yassalam. Virtual theater offerings include an original production, The Felt Menagerie, a Williams-inspired puppet comedy from the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans, Teatro Sin Fronteras, Theater Without Borders, showcasing the voices of Latin creatives in New Orleans and curated by Jose Torres Tama, Tennessee Williams one-act plays from the NOLA Project and Le Petit Theater du Vieux-Carré. Other theater-related events include New Orleans My Muse with Kathy Randalls and Stephanie McKee, moderated by Monique Verdun, and a panel on the New Orleans Black Theater community with Tommy Myrick, Kalamu Yassalam, Lauren Turner, Kaya Karen Livers, and Nick Sly. Check TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete schedule. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.